My ministry is of necessity working with political organizing because of the area in which I live. So I'll be speaking out of my experience in the ministry as well as having done political organizing. I also work in the arts, and they sort of dovetail with everything else. So we'll begin. I've changed what I want to say tonight about four or five times since midnight last night when I started working on it, of course. And it was based upon the changes were occurring in my head as I kept hearing people surface questions and reflecting upon the last week. And I know a lot of you are new today. Is that right? Yeah. Okay, well, this past week we've dealt with the theology of the cross. John Schramm talked about what it meant for us as Christians to be involved with the oppressed and the suffering of the earth. And then Magali Rodriguez and her husband James Mossman talked about multi-channeled communication. That is ways that middle-class people can work with lower-class people and blacks can work with whites, et cetera, et cetera. So that sort of grew out of this theology of the cross notion that we do need to be in solidarity with others, and to try to find ways to do that was part of the discussion. And then Dan has been doing a study of Ephesians where he was talking about everything, the whole civilization, the whole universe groaning together to come to some sense of unity. And all these themes were playing back and forth. I was doing sessions on prayer where I was talking about contemplation as becoming involved in the very isness of all of life. I heard a lot of, I saw a lot of hand-wringing going on. People saying, well, what can I understand this, but what can I do? What in my little town and so-and-so, or where I'm living, how is it possible for me to respond with the theology of the cross to the suffering of the world? And so what I'm getting at tonight, I guess, is my response and the way we've operated our ministry. So I want to tell you, first of all, just about the ministry that we have in Appalachia, and then to talk more about citizen action groups that I've become familiar with. Some of you may want to share things that I don't know. Alternative structures and models that are surfacing all over the country, as well as alternative communities, including Christian communities. And I hope that this part of it can be a sharing session where we're talking about, you know, what's worked for all of you. Then I have a short slideshow. It's 15 minutes, and it's of the June 12th march last year in New York City, with particular emphasis on the role that the arts played in building that movement for justice. So first of all, let me tell you a little bit about our ministry. It's based on this notion, I think, from Matthew Fox, that the appropriate response to the world is that of compassion. It's not a masochistic feeling guilty and therefore taking action, but it's based upon compassion, which is relieving pain, our own pain as well as the pain of our brothers and sisters, and celebrating our existence. And both of those things are involved in compassion. It's to try to view life from the underside, which is what I believe Jesus was doing. And we operate out of a liberation theology mode. That is that when students come to our center or faculty or whatever, we get them involved right away in action. Even before they're involved in Bible study or before they're involved in anything else, they move into what we have established are small communities of action. And those communities all get involved then on reflection with scripture and study regarding what they're doing in the world. So, for instance, when a student comes to our center and they read the bulletin board or they pick up the brochure, there'll be a list, and one of them will say Hunger Coalition. Another one will list four different peace groups that we have. One will say GALA, which is the Gay and Lesbian Alliance. Another one will say Ministry with International Students, Women's Programming, et cetera, et cetera. We have a whole number of these communities. And they, at the beginning of the year, will probably have five old returning students, as you know, they're so transient, they're off before you ever know it, and a few townspeople. But by June, they're communities that are very intact communities of 30 or 40 who are working. Then they all come together, all these mini communities come together weekly to worship, on Wednesday night to sing and exchange songs and poetry and other forms of art. There's also a leadership training program that we have for everybody. Anybody who surfaces as a leader in any one of these many communities goes through a 10-week organizing program, and it's very intensive. When they come out, they know how to organize. They have group dynamic skills. They have listening skills. They know how to run the media. They know the ins and outs of the university. They know how to relate to the community groups around. So anybody who surfaces as a leader, we insist, go through at least a 10-week course like that. We also have every other month what we call a social change exchange. All of these groups will get together and exchange out at my house where I have a log cabin in the woods, and they come out and exchange music, exchange food, spend about 10 hours together. And it's a marvelous experience. It's, again, a part of the celebration that helps people to remain compassionate because there's a lot of, you know, interchanging going on. Then we also have retreats, silent retreats, etc. So the ministry is primarily geared to meeting the hurt that we find within the university and within our community, but it is very much a celebrative community also. And when I think about what we could be doing in the new church and models that the normal churches could adopt, I feel as though this model has something to say to other people. I'm sure it's not new. Many of you may have very similar operations going on, but it's useful. Now, let me just tell you a bit about some of the issue work. The week I left, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance had just finished a four-week stint with the City Council. In research, first of all, whenever any of these groups take on an issue, they have to do a close analysis of what it is, and then they'll come to some kind of decision for action. Well, in researching the laws of the city, we found that there was a lot of discrimination in housing and employment for gay people. So the Gala group proposed an ordinance to the City Council, and it was going through its third hearing when I left. The whole town, I mean the entire community, was buzzing. I have never encountered so many letters to the editor, so many people passing out leaflets on the streets, so many people calling in on talk shows. And this was all operating out of our ministry with the students running it. It wasn't the staff. Our staff, we view ourselves as enablers, as people who do the behind-the-scenes training. We're very seldom out in front speaking on any of these issues. The students are the ones who have to be out there. And that goes with the notion of organizing, that it's not leaders who should be visible. It's those who are involved in the oppression themselves who've got to take the issue and own it and go with it. So anyway, I don't know what's happened. I haven't heard from home what's happened with this. But they were going through, again, tremendous organizing experience for these young people. And it was a worthy issue. It was a real issue. It wasn't something where they simply came and discussed, you know, their own feelings. They do that also during the week in their meetings. But this was something they could all get together and work on. And these gay people in our ministry are celebrating their gayness. They're not ashamed of it. They have come to affirm who they are as people as a result of having to deal with this thing at many, many levels. The international students we worked with took on the university structure and got them to divest of their investments in South Africa. It was a six-month campaign, and there was a lot of bitterness. We had to break into the Board of Trustees meeting. There was a lot of kind of direct action type techniques, but eventually the university divested of all of its investments in South Africa. This was something we did 2 years ago. The Hunger Coalition is right now setting up a food bank in cooperation with four other counties. They're working with low-income people to set up satellite food banks because in the hollows of Appalachia, lots of folks run out of food and they can't get to town. So we've got to have things accessible for them. This is a short-term emergency type thing. The women have set up a shelter for battered women, and they are working on getting women's studies further instituted. They got a women's studies certificate in the university structure program now. They're now going for a full-fledged major. The people who work on Appalachian issues are now doing, with my husband who's a sociologist, a land study of 28 southern Ohio counties. They are, with local people in all of the communities around us, going into the courthouses and very laboriously going over the court's records to find out who owns the land. And we're basing this upon a study that was done out of Highlander Center in Tennessee, where they found that corporate ownership of land is just everywhere. And that, you know, it's no wonder folks don't have access to the very thing that's closest to them, that is their land. And we have some actions in mind, depending upon what we find. But at this point, it's strictly research. But again, it's a meshing of students with local people. And it seems to be a very workable thing for us to do. So you can get an idea of what this ministry is like. And I want to stress, it's the people themselves who are doing it. We don't move on an issue. The staff won't move on an issue until the students own it, until they're ready to move on it. And we will, you know, spend a whole year doing education and consciousness raising regarding an issue if that's what it takes. But we won't take action until they're ready, and then they must do it, and we're simply backup. Very, very seldom will I be out front, or will the other staff people be out front. Okay, now, this, I think this differs somewhat from the traditional way churches have approached organizing or dealing with social justice. We have traditionally worked in acts of mercy, and by certain, we ought to keep up with those. We ought to still be visiting the prisons and visiting the sick and setting up temporary, immediate things like food pantries and food banks. Those are stopgap measures, but they don't bring about ultimate social change. They're still good things to be doing. The churches have traditionally responded through education, and I'm sure that many of you can cite really wonderful examples of education that are going on in your own parishes regarding hunger issues. I mean, Bread for the World is doing an incredible job, I think, with local churches. The peace movement is doing a wonderful job with educating on peace issues. And those are things that should be kept up. They're things that we do also. And we have responded as Christians and as Lutherans to being good citizens. That's an important part of who we are, to vote regularly and to work for the candidate of our choice and to write our letters to the editor and to our legislators. These are all good things. What I have sensed this week as people have been watching the films we've been showing is this hand-wringing. Like, we know that what we're doing isn't enough. And people surface these questions like, well, yes, I write to my legislator and, you know, I write my letter to the editor, but that isn't enough. And I guess I want to affirm that that's right, it's not enough. And maybe it's worth doing, but it isn't enough. And we have to begin in the church to take seriously what it means to organize. We have to be as serious about organizing with our oppressed brothers and sisters as the labor movement was in the 1800s when they set out to simply gain basic rights. And if we don't, then we're simply playing with the issues. I suspect that a lot of us, and that includes me, do a lot of this stuff because we know that the rest of the world views us as the oppressor. We are the white, privileged middle class. We're mobile, we're educated, and the rest of the world looks at us and says, well, you may feel for us, but do you really want to put your life on the line or yourselves on the line? Are you willing to reorganize your lives so that the main thing in your life is to see that justice is done, and not the main thing in your life is to see that you are self-fulfilled or self-actualized or whatever those other, you know, self-improvement groups talk about. That's where the hand-wringing comes in. We know somewhere that we are called by the gospel of Christ to be the suffering love community. And yet we know what we're doing is very liberal and very token. And I'm not excluding myself from this at all. I'm in that rut a lot, along with probably some of you. What I think we have to do is hear and acknowledge our privilege. There's no question that I, in the middle of Appalachia, as the wife of a professor and as a campus minister, am very privileged. But to move beyond that and then to acknowledge that and to say that's true and not feel guilty about that, but to simply take what I have been given or what you have been given and to let those gifts be transformed for the good of the community is, I think, where we have to go. Our personal transformation will go along with social transformation. They're linked. As we repent and move towards the gospel, we will be given the gifts of discernment to figure out what we have to do to be involved in real social transformation and not just token social transformation. As I was thinking about this, there's been something missing in our discussions this week. And I think what's been missing is a discussion of power. And what power is. Maybe it hasn't been discussed because it's been acknowledged and it hasn't surfaced. But I think we have to realize and recognize that power is held by a small percentage of people in this country. Within university structures, power is held by a very small percentage of people, and that most people feel powerless. And that's not just the people who are poor. Well, I think we have to recognize that we, by and large, are powerless. Now, that we're not ultimately powerless, but we don't hold the reins of power. We don't hold the key to the door always. And I think we need to recognize when we're doing community organizing that there is a swinging door that goes between those who hold economic power and those who hold political power. And that swinging door is very evident in the federal bureaucracy. I think it's evident in the state bureaucracies. And it certainly is true in universities where I work, that the people who sit on the boards of trustees of universities are, by and large, heads of large corporations. They aren't educators, and they're not students, and they're not graduate students, and they're not faculty. They're the people who hold the purse strings in the community. And that we have to recognize that that is a form of power that we have to deal with. I believe that we are moving from a democracy to an oligarchy in this country because of the small numbers of corporations and people who have control, and that the Christian church has to address that. It's not enough to simply appeal to our legislators. I think we have to recognize that our legislators are being appealed to every day in massive ways by very highly vested corporate interests, and that we're up against something really tough, and it's going to take a lot of hard organizing to turn that around. I think we know it, but we don't take seriously how much hard work that's going to mean. All right. Now, I guess it goes without saying that these economic structures, that the haves dominate the have-nots, and that the political system protects those who have. And those who have not are not as well protected, even though I think we'd like to believe we're well protected. An example of that, I was reading last night over here in the library for a while, and I read that 250,000 family farmers leave their land yearly. 250,000 family farmers leave their land yearly in this country because they're being bought out by large corporations. They simply cannot keep up with what it takes to run a farm and to purchase the equipment, and they're continually going in debt over and over again and can't even begin to pay the interest on their debts. That obviously leads to the exacerbation of the problems in the city. I mean, the city problems are, if you go back to it, our country problems, because people have to leave their farms and they're migrating to cities. We noticed that in Cincinnati, that the area in Cincinnati, which is called across the vine area there, is largely migrants from Appalachia who have had to leave their small farms. And a lot of them can't adjust, and they keep commuting back to West Virginia and Kentucky. But Cincinnati's problems are rural problems made urban. The first step for any of us who want to take seriously organizing is to do a careful analysis. And I think that that's beginning to happen in churches. Maybe you can, we can talk about this later, but I think that people are, particularly with the hunger issue, are beginning to make the links between the economic structures and the political structures and the local farmer. And I sense that that's a good thing that's going on. Is that right? I mean, people aren't just staying at the level of saying, well, we've got to feed the hungry, or that they're making these political connections. That's what we're hoping to do with this land study with the students where we're living in Appalachia, is to get them to realize, once we come out with who owns the land, what does that mean? What does that mean to have 3/4 of the land in this area owned by large corporations which are seated in New York and in Minneapolis and elsewhere? Then beyond the analysis, And we insist that all of our student groups go through this problem, this analysis thing, first of all, before they step out. Now, they move into the issue, and then, as soon as they get a taste for it, they come back and start doing some analyzing. Then comes the nuts and bolts organizing. Cy Khan, who is a wonderful organizer in the hills of Appalachia, who's done a lot of organizing in the cotton mills in the South, is now heading up part of the Citizen Labor Energy Coalition for the whole country, has written a book called Organizing, Organizing, Organizing. And he's also a folk singer and puts out many, many records where he uses the arts and the local arts of the indigenous people to do his organizing. I was reading his book and he said, organizing is people working together to get things done. Well, I mean, that's obvious, that's simple, you know, we've all done that. We've all put together bake sales, we've all done this and that. We've all organized to get things done. But the key is that we're organizing together. Together. We're not organizing, I'm not sitting in my dining room organizing individually. I'm organizing with other people in the Grange Hall. One person doing things won't get very far. Organizing is the opposite of doing your own thing, which is what a lot of young people come to college wanting to do. They want to do their own thing. Well, that's not organizing, and you never can get anything done if you're just going to do your own thing. Organizing is also different than helping people. And I've heard a lot of language around Holden about how we need to help the poor and we need to help the oppressed. We don't need to help them. They need to help themselves. Mostly we need to get out of the way. But if at all we can be helpful, if at all we can be of use, if at all we can join them, they have to show us and then they have to let us know what needs to be done. So good organizing will get rid of this notion that somehow because we're middle class and we're white and we're Christian, we've got the answers. Well, all we have to do is get it to them, and then they'll adopt it. And we all know this, but yet I think we keep on doing that. You know, we keep on trying to help other people. If you have power, you can get things done. So the key is to get the power out of the hands of the few and get the power less powerful. Not that you're going to make the oppressed become the oppressors. And lots of people say that. Oh, well, if you turn things around, well, then those folks, they're just going to become the oppressors. Well, I don't believe that for a moment. Well, we can discuss that later. The people who have the power now are the ones who are organized. Take a look at the AMA. What is more organized than the AMA? I mean, there's nobody more organized than the AMA. They've got the power, right? So if we feel powerless, it's because we don't have the power, and we don't have the power because we're not organized. So we got to get organized. That's what has to happen. I'm 43, and in a lot of the rights that were won, that I enjoy, a lot of the privilege that I enjoy was won by hard organizing on the part of other people before me. And I think we have to remind ourselves. It's like the liturgy. We need to remind ourselves of what went before and what's to come. I started just listing last night a few things. Price support, soil conservation, abolition of child labor, minimum wage, maximum hours, right to vote, right to organize unions, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Securities and Exchange Commission, Social Security, unemployment insurance, disability insurance. All of that was done by hardcore local organizing, and it was tough. There was one talk I wanted to give here, and I haven't been able to do it because it just hasn't been able to fit in. I wanted to give a history of the labor movement, and particularly the textile movement, because that's my area is textiles, and I've studied the labor movement there. And by gummy, I'll tell you, those women in those mills in Massachusetts and in South Carolina, they put their lives on the line just to get the right to have 8-hour days and minimum wage. And we take all that for granted as middle-class people. We don't even know. I mean, we know, but we don't know what it really means not to have these kinds of wonderful things that we do have. Organizing is the American way. And lots of students come, and when we, first of all, you know, we put them into these groups and we say we're going to do some organizing, they'll say, oh, I can't write home about that. My mother will think I've turned communist. Mm-hmm. Or that's something that radicals do. Well, you know, is this like this? Is this like the 60s? Is this what the radicals did? Well, it is. But organizing is American way. We've all done that, right? I mean, this is the way our country grew. It's the democratic way. The benefits of organizing are that things get done. If you don't get organized, things don't get done. People come to the center and they want to talk about things. We say, okay, you want to talk about things or you want to get things done? You can talk about these issues till the cows come home. And you can analyze them and keep reading, and you can, you know, keep saying, well, I'm not prepared enough to get out there and do it. I've got to learn more. Well, you know, we certainly need to know our facts. We can't go out like fools. But there comes a point where we simply have to get out there and get organized and get the job done. The other benefit of organizing is that people discover who they are. It's like prayer. In prayer, we discover who we are. In organizing, you discover who you are because you discover where you're powerless and where you're powerful. You discover where your failures are and where your gifts are. You discover who you are in the midst of other people. And it's marvelous to see how we grow when we actually start working with other people on serious issues. Ultimately, I think that organizing is good stewardship. It's good stewardship. And I'm not sure we practiced good stewardship in this area. We've talked too much. We've spent too much time studying and reading and not enough time actually doing what we're called to do. And organizing puts an end to paternalism. The missionary movement has been accused of a lot of paternalism. I think the church at large has been accused of a lot of paternalism, and some of it's true. We have been paternalistic. When you start working with other folks of other colors and other classes and other races, etc., you begin to realize who you are and really how important you are, but also how insignificant you are. And you begin to realize that the answers have to come from the multitudes of people, not from the leaders. Good organizing is not going to the top and appealing to the power structure at the top and asking them to change. Good organizing occurs from the bottom up with the people. And occasionally you appeal to the top. But it's organizing that simply wants to go to the president of the university to ask him to change a rule or to the board of trustees without having built a base of lots of people, that's simply not, the change won't last. Well, why don't more of us organize for change? Why do we continue to work alone? And I've asked that so many times of myself and of other people. I believe it's because we have been taught in this society to believe that our individual problems take individual solutions. And I think that that's something which keeps us separated. We blame ourselves for our problems. When gay people first come to our ministry, they are so self-effacing. I mean, they blame themselves for everything. And when we start talking about going out on the street and approaching city council, they just withdraw into themselves. It's the same thing when I meet with poor people in Appalachia, when I go to visit with them, or when we're making plans for something in the community. They know that I'm middle class. I dress like it. I talk like it. And the first thing that I sense the posture, it's like they shuffle their feet and like try to cover their bodies with their hands. And lots of times they don't have teeth, and so that they'll talk so that their mouths don't quite open. And they're blaming themselves for where they are. And they say that, they apologize. They say, well, Mr. Kerr, I'm sorry, my house isn't better, and all I've got to offer you is a little bit of tea, or excuse my clothes, or whatever. We have learned to blame ourselves, and we have learned to allow people to blame themselves. Till we can begin to see our individual problems require group solutions, and that most of the individual problems in this society are due to structural things that need structural change and not just individual change, we won't take organizing seriously. It's like battered women. I have a foster daughter that grew up in my home, and when she left, she got into a situation where she was battered, and she wasn't allowed to come home for a couple of years. And after I finally was able to make contact with her again, she was blaming herself for having been battered. And it wasn't until she started talking to other battered women and realized that this is a structural thing, that she was married into a situation of extreme poverty, that her husband had been battered as a child, that his initial response was to do that, until she realized that her problems were due to structural problems of poverty, and that there were lots of other women in that same county going through the same thing.
Not until that point was she ready to get out and organize. She is now out of the situation. She is now organizing other low-income women in her area, and she is a strong woman. But until that point, she blamed herself, and she would say that to me. I think we can go on and on with example after example, how poor people, those who you see at the welfare office, if you're there doing work, will apologize to you for why they are the way they are, without recognizing that they're there because of structural problems and that this system that we have needs poor people as a base. And when they begin to realize that and understand why their condition is the way their condition is, then they become powerful. They don't become rich, but they become powerful because they know. They know who they are and they know what has to be done. And then they can show us how we can help them. How we can work with them is really a better way of saying, I think. So I believe we're making headway in this, and I think that the peace and hunger movement are helping us to understand the necessity for understanding things structurally, but we still have a ways to go. I need to check my time here. What time is it? What time does everybody have?
7:30.
Okay. All right. We're going to see the slideshow in a few minutes because Marianne wouldn't be back till 7:30. Okay. We're just a few minutes, Marianne. All right. Magali and James, I think, raised for us the whole problem of figuring out ways, effective ways to bring people together who are from different classes, different races, different sexes, etc. And one of the ways that they talked about was to use the arts. And hardcore organizing sounds very hard, and it often is very hard, and people burn out very fast. If you're in it for a while, you burn out. And you burn out unless you have cultural activities going on. And so we always try to be careful to build that in right from the very beginning. People have got to enjoy being with each other, because when you take on some of these issues, you better believe that the powers that be are going to come down on you. It's going to be hard, and you're going to feel a lot of the pain. So if you can have fun doing it, and you can not only have fun, if there's something which comes out of the cultural wealth of the people, it's a sustaining thing. I think Matthew Fox was right when he said that the bridge between personal transformation and social transformation is the arts, and that any society that doesn't have the arts within it is a very unjust society. Where you have justice, you're going to have people celebrating even the small things in life, the daily things, even the food. And you notice, if you're working with low-income folks, there's always a soup, beans, and cornbread there. I mean, they always are celebrating the little that they have, and they have fun together. So I think that what I'd like to do, well, I want to just briefly go over a few of these things, and then I want to show you the slideshow, and then we'll have some time to talk. There is a movement in this country called Citizen Action, and I found some folks here who didn't know about it. That's why I'm mentioning it. Here's the newsletter that comes out. In Ohio, we have our own Citizen Action newsletter. There are about 14 or 15 states that now have Citizen Action movements, and these Citizen Action groups are taking on the issues that really affect low-income folks. When our hunger group went out and started working among low-income folks, they wanted to give them food. Well, that was the immediate thing. They realized that the big problem for poor folks is the fact that their utility bills are so high, and that up to 40 to 50% of their incomes go for utilities. Now, we all have high utility bills, but when you're low income, I mean, almost half your family budget goes to it. So what they needed was relief on the utilities, and they were ready to work on it. They simply needed a little bit of people, you know, people who knew the system to plug them in. And that's all we're doing with our groups. And we have a very strong group now. I went up to Columbus last week, the week before I came here, with two very, very low-income women. And my role wasn't to go in and to speak to the utility company. My role was to make sure that they could find their way around Columbus and get them to the right door. And I left them at the door. They went in. They were scared to death. They came out totally beaming. I mean, they had made grand headway. So this is the way we, as middle-class people, can be enablers. We're working in our local area with that issue. We're working with people who are being bothered by toxic waste. I've got students in the ministry who are out working with people who are being affected by longwall mining, which is a new mining technique. It's worse than strip mining. And last week, my husband wrote to me. He had taken down a carload of these low-income people to testify before Congress on this thing. There are ways we can be of assistance, but they've got to take the lead. And they're doing it. They're just incredibly articulate. Anyway, if you're not familiar with Citizen Action, come and get the address later and write to them. They'll put you on the newsletter, and you may find that there's a movement in your state. They're also the folks who are spearheading a lot of the work on the farm foreclosure issue. Those of you from the Midwest, you know how many farms are being foreclosed upon, and they're taking strong lead in working with that. The training center for Citizen Action is the Midwest Academy in Chicago. As soon as I get home, I'm going off to Midwest Academy for a five-day training session. They have them spread around the country so that you can get in touch with how to get organizing training. Another good center is Highlander Center in Tennessee, but that's primarily for low-income people. So there's that movement. Then there's the Citizen Labor Energy Coalition, CLEC, which is working on the rollback and freeze of natural gas prices and on decontrol issues. These are the big issues for low-income people in this country, and we had better be involved as a church. If we're talking about poverty, we can't avoid energy. That's where it is. That's the biggest problem this country faces, other than the defense issue, as far as I'm concerned, is energy. Then there are other alternative structures and models that are popping up everywhere. Lots of you know about food co-ops and alternative schools. The Movement for a New Society is an organizing group that grew out of the Quaker centers in Philadelphia, and they're now spread out all over the country also. These folks are not so much interested in doing issue organizing as they are in creating alternative structures. And so in our area, the Movement for a New Society is setting up a new learning center. It's going to be a whole different kind of a center, a combination of a library, a place where low-income people will come to meet with university people to talk about new ways to approach solving the problems in our area. They're doing this all over, Movement for a New Society. If you don't know about them, I can also get you their address. There are people who are setting up land trusts. We have a number of land trusts in our area, and this book, Taking Charge, is put out by American Friends Service Committee, and they talk about land trusts. There's also a book called Land Trusts. If you have land and you don't want to pass it on to your kids, like I'm not going to pass it on to my kids, they're middle class, they're educated, they'll make it. My land's going into a land trust for people in my area. And you may want to consider if you own large pieces of land or even small. There's a fellow at Rockwell International in Columbus. Are we going to show that film this week? Gods of Metal?
I haven't decided yet, but it's available.
Okay. Well, Gods of Metal features this man named Tom Seamer. He was a vice president at Rockwell. He decided what he was doing was creating a death machine. He quit his job, and he called us up about a month ago and said he was turning over all of his vacation land into a land trust for a peace academy in Ohio. And this summer, people from our ministry, as well as the ministries in Columbus, are going there to help set up the peace academy. I mean, what better thing to do with all the wealth and the land he had accumulated as the vice president of Rockwell? It's just, you know, marvelous stuff. But that's an alternative structure. It's something that's a different kind of organizing. We have, in Athens, formed the Friends and Neighbors Bank, F&R Bank, we call it. And those of us who are more privileged than our brothers and sisters who are coming in to the area, loan money. I mean, we loan money without interest to people. We just take what's in our bank account and give it to somebody else for a while, and then they just take it and give it to somebody else for a while. It's called the Friends and Neighbors Bank. Our friends don't have to go to the bank and pay high interest rates to get, you know, to get money. So there's things we can do. We can be creative. We don't have to depend upon what's already there. We can figure out new ways we also do lots of bartering. All of the, we're in litigation, and three or four different litigation situations now with our organizing out of our Citizen Action Group, and we have bartered every bit of the attorney's fees. The people I was telling you about, the ones who are the low-income folks who are out there, they will do wood splitting and pie baking, etc. And every bit of their attorney's fees, which I mean are mounting up way, way into the, you know, close to $100,000 now, are being paid for by bartering. And it's wonderful to find attorneys who are willing to do that.
Yeah, pay taxes on it.
Yeah, right. That's right. But anyway, it sure helps our folks, because we could never have gone into those situations without doing that. The time is going too fast. Oh, there's all kinds of alternative communities. You know about them. I mean, a lot of you probably read Sojourners, and you know what they're doing. Larry's in an alternative situation in D.C. I mean, there's lots of folks here who are involved in alternative communities. That's for sure something we can do. I don't think that we ultimately will be of much help, that we will be able to really be involved in this unless we move out of the patterns of all of us living in middle-class neighborhoods, out in the suburbs somewhere, where we can't have access to people. We have to figure out ways where we're going to be more in touch with each other at a daily level. And we may have to begin in small ways by moving our churches, but we may have to also consider moving where we, moving our own residences, or somehow setting up partners with, churches becoming partners with other churches, or people becoming partners with other people. We've got to be creative about ways, because as long as we stay surrounded in our white middle-class neighborhoods, we're not going to have our consciousness daily raised enough to work on this stuff. We've got to figure out other ways to do that.